That's great. Nice to be here. And we've been spared too much rain. Hope it's all going well under your canvas situation. That's good. I want to tell you about how physics means that you have to weed your garden today, but we'll get to that a bit later on. So physics affects everything, bedrooms, gardens, the entire works. But what we're looking at today is the concept of home, as this whole festival is about, of course. And I want to focus on home from an ecological point of view. Now, why should I use ecology to look at home? Well, it's simply because ecology means the study of the home. It comes from oikos, the ancient Greek word, of course, meaning home or family. And so that's an immediately important point to begin with, because our ecology is our home. And if we don't get that, as the majority of the governments on the planet don't get, then we will unfortunately be ejected from that ecology most likely and find ourselves homeless, which will not be a comfortable thing. So I'm going to explore that a little bit. But first of all, I want to divide the talk into two bits. I want to divide the talk into the way that most of the world, including most of us, probably including me as well, a philosophy that we all share. There is a common philosophy. Now, we know that there's lots of different philosophies in the world. Some are existentialists. That's a fun philosophy. I always wanted to be an existentialist, but never was brave enough or French enough. But that's it's a really cool one to go for. There's the philosophy of nihilism. Oh, dear. Yes, that's a really depressing one as well. And we all drift into nihilism at times, of course, when things get bad. But the philosophy I'm going to talk about is one that everybody shares. It's the philosophy of the Enlightenment. And it is the main philosophy that drives the planet at the moment. So we'll come on to that. And after that, I want to then go on and look at conservation biology and the philosophy that they adopt, which is the polar opposite of the Enlightenment. And then I want to look at why both are wrong, and then try to come to a more interesting philosophy that both will save the planet and that will save our conservation areas from the marauding disaster that most conservation groups actually are. So we'll come to that in a little bit. Okay, so let's get started. It's not a controversial talk at all, okay, so it'll be fine. I can't see anybody's bought any fruit with them, so I'm pleased about that, because I passed a fruit stall earlier. Oh no, eat that quickly. Okay, I won't get any controversial bits. To all fruit is eaten, that's good. And I can die for cover nowhere. There's very little protection up here, so let's go for this anyway. Okay, so first philosophy is the philosophy of progress. And many people in the world believe that home is in the future. Home is in the future. Now, many Christians believe that too, of course, that home is in the future. We are going home. My uncle used to play in a Christian country and western band in Northern Ireland called High Country, and one of their big hits as such was Going Home to Jesus Over in the Sweet By and By. And this concept of going home is a major thing. If you're John Denver, home is actually West Virginia, of course, but that's John Denver for you. And unfortunately, he crashed his plane and didn't get there. So that was unfortunate for him. But anyway, moving on from John Denver, we want to go home. And home is in the future. Now, the nice thing about having home in the future is that it's not connected to anything in the past. The past's a mess. It's all bad. The present's a bit of a mess. But that doesn't matter, because home is ahead. That allows us to get rid of all of the negative experiences we've had, because there is a pure future that we can get to. Now, it's not just the Christian church that believes this. In fact, the majority of the planet believes this, because this comes from the Enlightenment, an incredible philosophical moment as such, in geological time at least, that happened in the 17th and 18th centuries, around the French Revolution. Many of the main philosophers were French, of course. Some were Scottish and some were English. And I'm going to talk about three of those very briefly. The Marquis de Condorcet was an amazing French revolutionary. He led the way, and he wrote the new educational sort of philosophy for France. He designed the new constitution for France, but he didn't agree that the king should die. He didn't agree that the king should be executed. So the Marquis de Condorcet had to go into hiding because the other revolutionaries were going to kill him. Now, it's amazing to look at the French Revolution and what happened there, because it's a warning for Libya and what could happen there. Unfortunately, it's probably too late for them to read the writings of Condorcet today. But anybody here who wants to form a revolution, you should read the Marquis of Condorcet's life story and his philosophy. Extraordinary man. He went into hiding, and he was hidden by the widow of a printer in Paris. and he stayed there for about 9 months. And while he was there, he wrote his greatest work, which is one of the most powerful writings of the Enlightenment. And it was the most positive work you could imagine. It was about progress. It said that the human race could achieve perfection by two things, by using reasoning and by using technology. He predicted the internet. He said that at one stage in the future, all of mankind would be able to communicate with each other without a foghorn going off. And would be able to communicate with each other without any kind of physical contact. That this would be global and it would connect humankind into the one grouping. He predicted the United Nations. He said the governments of the world would come together to form a group that could interact in terrible times in any one country. And this was all in the 1700s, quite an extraordinary man. And this was while he was locked away with a sentence of death hanging over him. So he spelled out this beautiful picture. But when you think about the book, and then you think about where he was writing it, it's quite extraordinary. Would you or I be able to write such a positive book about humans? Humans being able to achieve so much while we were locked away in a small room, hiding in fear of death from the very revolutionaries that we had been a part of. Quite an extraordinary story, really, Condorcet. So reasoning and technology. David Hume took up this call as well in Scotland and Edinburgh. Reasoning and technology. And Adam Smith, of course, the famous economist, again, by reasoning, by technology, we can work our way towards a utopia. We can progress to that point of utopia. And in England, William Godwin was the main driver of this, an extraordinary man, as we'll find out. Now, what was all this about? Why did the Enlightenment happen when it did? It was in reaction to two things. First of all, it was in reaction to the church being very dominant at the time, and it was in reaction to the state being very dominant at the time. These two great powers were suppressing the human's ability to create, is what these philosophers were saying. And freed from church and state, humankind on their own, notably, will be able to progress to a utopia. We had the answers within us, and we could progress along this path by using our reasoning and our technology to a greater future. And when that was written down in the late 1700s, it was to be changed the direction of thinking across the world, both ecological, both evolutionary, as I'll mention in a little bit, and more importantly, economically. Economic philosophy was then driven by Adam Smith's incredible writings of Wealth of Nations, of course. So these great thinkers came together and set out this path. Now, it was quite interesting because Godwin went one step further. William Godwin's a fascinating guy. And he grew up in the east of England, Norfolk area. And he became a churchman, first of all. And then he was given some books to read. And it led him astray, basically. And he left the church and went in to become a philosopher eventually. His daughter was called Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein, of course. But his story is an extraordinary life story. He basically had a love of his life called Mary Wollstonecraft, and she was a leading feminist at the time, a very, very leading feminist. And he didn't believe in marriage at all. He was against all state and church structures, basically. He founded the whole philosophy of really getting rid of the state from the system and freeing yourself up to go on to that sort of your own decision-making. Unfortunately, they got a little too close, and Mary became pregnant, Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, this was disastrous for both of them because he'd been a religious man, he believed that he should marry Mary and therefore to bring up the child in a married home. So they got married. So this was a disaster because he had always said marriage is ridiculous. It's a thing of the state. And unfortunately, his currency sharply descended at that stage. And he became a laughingstock, really, in the country. The newspapers made fun of him. And this was in the late 1700s. Newspapers did that then as well. And they gave him a really hard time, basically, which is a nightmare for him. Anyway, even worse than that, his wife died a week after childbirth. So having gone through the terrible turmoil this pregnancy caused them, unfortunately, then she died. But Mary Shelley, of course, Shelley was to marry Percy Shelley, the great poet, and she caused her father loads of trouble as well, because at 17 she eloped with this crazy poet, and they headed off to Italy together, Percy Shelley and Godwin's daughter. And Percy Shelley's wife then committed suicide as a result of this. The story gets worse and worse. And poor Godwin was just in a complete state of disarray by this stage. His wife, he had to get married. He'd lost the respect of his peers. His wife had died in childbirth. His daughter had eloped at 17 with a crazy poet. And then, to make things worse, then the poet's wife had committed suicide as a result of this. That's a pretty bad scene, really. And yet he was able to write a philosophy that was one of the most positive in the world. So it seems to do this to people. It's weird, isn't it? The people who get horrific things, sentence of death hanging over them, wives committing suicide, wives dying in childbirth, other wives committing suicide, daughters running off with crazy poets, and they start writing really positive stuff in books. It's an extraordinary thing. And that's an interesting lesson, actually. I think through the hardest times, you get a clearer picture, maybe, of where things are at. It's fascinating. So Godwin, anyway, wrote his great work. And in it, he said, not only would man get to perfection, but when he was at perfection, he would live forever. He went one step further. And he said Utopia was a place where reasoning and where technology would bring us to, and not only would everything be perfect, but it would be eternal. So he was replacing the eternal promise of the church in a heaven with a land-based, human-based promise of eternity, of everlasting life. And of course, not everybody thought he was sane. And because of everything that had gone before, they started to call him the immortal Godwin. And in fact, his wife-to-be got married a second time, and as he was passing underneath her balcony in a very Romeo and Juliet fashion, the story goes that she called down to you, "Ah, is this the immortal Godwin?" And he stared up, their eyes met, and he found happiness for the rest of his life with his second wife. So the story has a happy ending in the end, which is rather nice. So let's get back to the theory then, the philosophy of progress. Mankind, humankind, can think together, can reason it out, away from the pressures of state, away from the pressures of the church, getting rid of these external pressures, we, and we alone, can solve the entire problem. That's what the philosophy of Enlightenment says, and it's what runs through everything that humans do just about today. Because in the end, we're all striving for a better world, and we use this as an excuse to destroy the world around us. But we don't view that we're destroying it because we don't think about it anymore. We don't need to, because it's all inside us. The answers lie within us. We have cut ourselves from the church, we have cut ourselves from the state, but we've also cut ourselves from the biosphere. We have separated ourselves, and we are now going on forward. And this is a place I call bubble world. The philosophy of the Enlightenment has licensed this kind of thinking. And when I look at most of the solutions coming out, I think this is ridiculous. That's not going to solve anything. The question is, why is it being done? It's because most of the thinkers who are behind these ideas are trapped in what we call bubble world. Bubble world is a place of isolation. It's a place of separation. It's a place of ignorance, and it's a place of complete arrogance. And it's quite interesting when we look at the names that we've given ourselves as scientists. We call our species, our subspecies, Homo sapiens sapiens, the wise, wise ones, and our nearest relative before us is called Homo habilis, the doer or the handyman. And these two terms sum up the Enlightenment philosophy. Reasoning, sapiens, sapiens, habilis, technology. We are the Homo habilis and the Homo sapiens. We are the doers and the thinkers on this planet. And we have named the rest of nature as nature raw in tooth and claw. Nature is an ignorant place. Nature is a place that needs taming. It needs our control over it. We need to get in there and do stuff to it. We need to sort it out. Because nature can't possibly know anything, but we know how to do things. Nature is made of organisms with genes in them that need to be changed. We need to improve the crops. We will change some of these genes and we will improve them. Now, let me just tell you how stupid that actually is, very briefly. We've only got two kinds of improved crops at the minute. One is resistant to insects, and And that's a very, very powerful one. And the other one is the resistance to sort of plant, sort of fungal attack. Now, these two major kinds of genes that we've plugged into these plants are doing a fine job. They will improve the plant, and they will improve the efficiency of the plant to withstand the problems. Two papers recently out show that there is resistance building to both of these. Now, if you've got a crop that you've put extra work into, extra genes into to make it do things, that plant actually is having to use some of the carbon that it could put into food into making the proteins you've told it has to make. You're saying, right, plant, you will also make these proteins as well as your normal set. Now, that's fine as long as everything is going well. That's fine. So we've got this plant now that's using a bit of its carbon to protect itself. We've got this plant that isn't. So we've got the non-GM plant and the GM plant sitting here. However, the reason why this is advantageous is because it can resist the attack that this one can't. This one's getting taken out. It dies, or it's less productive, so it's not very good. This one's better, it's more productive, and therefore it's doing a good job. That's a totally reasonable argument, I would say. The only problem is that once you get resistance building up, then the advantage that this plant had is no longer there, and so it is reduced to being the same as this plant, except it is also still having to make the additional proteins. And so the energy consumption of this plant is now greater than this plant because they're on an equal playing field again. The playing field has been leveled, and disease resistance levels playing fields, importantly. So in the future, and not even very far in the future, because we've already got resistance building up to the two main genetically modified crops that we have out there, this playing field is leveling up. And as it levels up, then we no longer have the advantage. And in fact, what was an advantage is now a disadvantage. We will have crops that are actually less able to produce sugar than we had before, because they're diverting their sugar resources into making proteins that are of no advantage to them whatsoever. So this is a very significant issue with GM. And of course, we should understand this, because bubble world is a place where it makes sense. Short-term solutions are what we get in bubble world, things that help us. We will change this, we will change that. It's a drive to efficiency, and efficiency is something that we all think is a great thing. Well, this will be more efficient. That's great, isn't it? Efficiency is great. That's another bubble world phenomenon. Efficiency isn't great. Because if we look at the biosphere as a whole, inefficiency is central to every level. You're a squirrel. Okay, imagine you're a squirrel and you've got a pile of nuts that you've gathered and you're gonna hide them somewhere. And you hide them off in a corner of the woodlands and you bury them. You've hidden those nuts and it's great. You go and hide some more nuts and hide some more nuts. Now, imagine you're a squirrel who can memorize telephone directories and give any number out of them. You've got a perfect memory. You're Mr. Sort of Memory Man Squirrel sitting there, and you know where every stash of nuts is. You have to put them there, and then three steps over, there's another stash by the big oak tree, just down from that, over by a small holly bush. I had a set there 2 years ago, which was 57 nuts exactly. This squirrel's no fool. Don't mess with this squirrel. Okay, he knows where everything is. Then we've got another squirrel in the forest who unfortunately is an amnesiac. He can't even remember where his tail is, and that's pretty obvious for a squirrel. So, oh no, where did I put my nuts? I can't remember any of them. It's a disaster, absolutely disaster. He's completely useless, and what's going to happen to him? He's going to starve to death, and it's going to be terrible, and everybody's going to be really upset, because he's actually a really nice squirrel, just a bit forgetful. But squirrels are quite selfish, so he couldn't get any nuts from any other squirrel, so it was all pretty, you know, it's friendship, but, you know, friendship only goes so far, mate. You're not getting any of my nuts, okay? If you can't remember where you buried your nuts, that's your problem, I'm afraid. So that poor squirrel starved to death. The other squirrels then came to dominance, of course, with their hyperly great memory. And over many centuries, all of the acorns were hidden and eaten. And slowly but surely, the forest died. There were no new trees came up at all. And if it hadn't been for the forgetful squirrels, there wouldn't be any more oak trees. So what we need is an appropriate level of amnesia in the squirrel forest complex. We need some of the squirrels to forget where some of the nuts are, and then those nuts can grow into oak trees. Let me give you a more scientific, if you like, example of this. Mutations. If mutations were corrected perfectly all of the time, we would still be a very, very small and simplistic little organism living in a hydrothermal vent down at the bottom of the ocean. That might be a better thing, actually, for the planet, but we'd be living down there. There'd be no change to the DNA. That DNA molecule wouldn't change because all of the DNA would be exactly the same. It wouldn't actually have any alteration. But mutations allow the codes to become more chaotic. Mutations represent noise in an information theory way. So we start off with a DNA molecule. Over time, DNA gradually becomes more chaotic through the second law of thermodynamics, of course, as mutations randomly hit the code and alter it. And so the code becomes more and more chaotic. And as it becomes more and more chaotic, along that journey towards chaos, it produces different sequences of proteins that form different functional units that produce the various amazing diversities of life we have. Think about 8.3 million species at the last count. And so as we see DNA becoming further and further mutated, that's not a bad thing. But too much mutation is a bad thing. Too much mutation will kill you or kill your generations in the future. No mutation, and we don't get any change, and there's very little option for variation there to allow us to answer the changing questions and explore new parts of the biosphere. And so we need an appropriate amount of mistakes. We need an appropriate amount of misinformation, if you like, of the DNA becoming more and more chaotic. Too much disaster, too little disaster. So at the DNA level, at the squirrel in the forest level, we need some noise. We need some mistakes to be made. We need inefficiency in the system. Now, if any of one of those levels was perfectly efficient, and if we could change that to make it perfectly efficient, like we do everything else, we build combine harvesters that are very efficient at sweeping the grain from the fields, leaving very little for the granivores that would seek to eat those seeds. We efficiency is driver for so much that we do. Efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. And that's a classic sign of one level of organization in the biosphere thinking it's the only level. It's a reductionist kind of thinking. We think that we can solve this by altering the genes, the ultimate neo-Darwinian argument, of course. We think we can solve this by making our machinery more efficient. We can think we can solve this by making our agriculture more efficient. But efficiency is not in the natural world. And you know why it's not? Because every level of organization is connected to every other level. The individuals are part of populations, the populations are part of ecosystems, and the ecosystems are part of the biosphere. And the function of the whole, the totality, the biosphere, will demand that the other levels are inefficient at levels. If you take any organism out there, if you take a cow and you were a carnivore, and you're not, so you don't need to eat cows, but if you were a carnivore and you ate cows, if those cows became completely efficient at stopping you from eating them, then you would starve to death. But let's look at a more worrying thing. If plants became totally efficient at stopping you from eating them, then we'd all be messed up because the energy into the system comes by far by the majority from the sun. Hydrothermal vents supply a small amount, but the majority of the energy that runs the biosphere comes from the sun. And so if the plants became hyper-efficient at stopping you eating them with some crazy toxin that made you go mad and run off a cliff, then very quickly the rest of the biosphere would be at the bottom of the cliff. The only things that would survive for a while would be the saprobes and the detritivores that ate all the dead things that had fallen off the cliff. And then they could eat each other, of course. So quite possibly the saprobes could keep going in that system. But if they tried to eat some of those plants, they too would go crazy and jump off the cliff. So in other words, what we're thinking about here is that we need inefficiency. And so the human race has got to be prepared to embrace inefficiency. Stop trying to do everything perfectly, because that's not the way nature works. Nature is inefficient. We were part of nature. We should be inefficient. The drive to efficiency comes from the Enlightenment. It comes from progress. It comes from technology. It's a drive for perfection. Anyway, let's quickly judge how well we're doing here. We've just about run out of time. Have we? No, I've got another half an hour. That's great. Thank goodness. A fright there. It's 10 o'clock in. Good. What we're going to do now is, first of all, think about the sign that the Enlightenment isn't necessarily working. Okay, we've got all this planet going on. It looks great. We've got grass growing. We've got horses running by occasionally. It's all fantastic. I haven't seen any running horses since I got here, but there are horses running by here, if you're here at the right time. And it's all going, singing, dancing planet. It looks great. Extinction rates are 200 times higher than they should be, than the background would suggest they should be. That's a problem. The ozone layer over Scotland has dropped dramatically. The rate of skin cancer in the county I'm in, Perthshire, has risen fourfold in the last 5 years, the rate of that, which is a very, very serious increase. And that's because the northern ozone layer is now reduced by 40%, the southern ozone layer by 50%, and the ozone thinning lasts longer into the spring, meaning that if the sun's strength increases, we're getting a greater exposure. 70% of all Australians will have skin cancer before they die. Let's say that again. 70% of all Australians will have skin cancer before they die. Now, this is not some shock and awe approach here. These are facts. These are facts written by the Scottish, or by the Scottish government and by the Australian government in reports. And you can access them all in my book. I've given references to all of these facts. So let's not escape the fact that we are in significant problems here. I'm not mentioning even global climate change. That's a significant problem as well. We'll come on to that maybe briefly later. But the planet isn't a significant problem, and it's all down to us, and it's all down to our reasoning and technology, because we've separated ourselves from our original place in nature. We were part of it. We were part of it. We were in conversation within a balanced system. I'll tell you how the biosphere works. It doesn't work by nature raw and tooth and claw, a severe competition. It works in three ways. It works by the flow of energy and resources through it. It works by the production of entropy, and it works by the balance of the system at all levels, working in a balance, which includes inefficiency. These things are what keep the biosphere going. Flow of energy and materials, the recycling as part of that flow, going round and round. Then we get the energetics going through it, converting energy into less useful energy, and then we get the balance that comes out of that. It's about a balance. Now, let me tell you why it's about a balance. Okay, I'm going to talk about a forest here and why physics explains why your garden needs continual weeding. So you got your garden, and it's a nightmare. It's probably beautiful, but on some days it's a nightmare because you're having to continually go out every single day, prune it, weed it, fix it. And it keeps wanting to do something different. And there's a reason for that. You're fighting against the second law of thermodynamics. That's what you're trying to do. You're a King Canute of sorts, because you're trying to stand in the way of the natural order. Now, what is the natural order? The natural order is a thing called succession. And if you go to a sand dune area at any estuary around here, if it hasn't been converted into a lynx course, then you'll find a beautiful sand dune succession. So don't get confused. Don't go to the golf course. It has got sand bunkers, but there's not a lot else in common with a succession. But usually there are a few left. One of the best ones is Tensmuir Point, which is just beside the old course in St Andrews. It's the next beach up, basically. But it's managed to escape a golf course, unlike most sand dune successions in Scotland. It's still there as a sand dune succession. So you're going to try to work out why you have to garden, wander down to this beach. You start at the bottom of the beach and walk inland, and gradually you get some little plants appearing. And you'll recognize some of these. There's some dandelions there fairly early on, some daisies you'll come across, some lichens, then we get some shrubs, and then we get some trees, and then we come to a forest. Now, take a wander into the forest and look at it on a nice summer's day. You'll see some beautiful ground violets growing. You see oxalis, a beautiful little plant springing up. You'll see the oak trees and pine trees fairly spread out, light reaching the ground, some shrubs growing, and it's beautiful. And you can go back next year, and it'll look almost the same. And you can stay there for the entire year, and I'll bet you any money at all that you won't see somebody going in with a strimmer. Oh, well, it's time to strim the forest. Bit of weeding, weed killer, definitely. It was green fly, my goodness. Oh, quick, spray those green fly. This forest's a mess. It needs to be looked after. You don't need to do any of that, because the forest is completely at home with itself. The forest has reached the stage of ecological climax, and it'll stay like that for a long time, a very long time, probably hundreds of years, untouched by humankind, just a beautiful, working, balanced forest. And that is nature. That is the biosphere. It doesn't need our interference. It doesn't need us going in to do anything to it. It has reached that point. And that point, interestingly, a paper just came out in the Royal Society, Proceedings of the Royal Society last summer. That point is the point of maximum production of chaos. That forest is producing more entropy than anything else. And gradually, as the forest grew, it produced more and more chaos. It's the second law of thermodynamics said the universe is heading towards greater chaos. That forest is releasing chaos in terms mostly of heat than all the rest of it before. And as it gradually increases, it reaches that peak. And then it doesn't increase any more in the amount of chaos it produces. It levels off. So physics can trace the growth of the forest and then the cessation, the stability of the forest as such. It just smooths off like that. Now, in your garden, you're at the start of this. And the laws of the universe are saying this thing needs to move. It needs to produce more chaos. It's not producing sufficient chaos. This is called maximum entropy production, is the scientific term for this, producing more and more chaos. So you're standing there with your pruning shears and your fork, and you're trying to stand against the forces of the universe. You're like Darth Vader in wellies. You know, it's a mad situation to be in. And there you are. Oh, no, I'm going to stop this. It's trying to become a forest. It will not become a forest on my watch. It's going to be a rose bed with some magnolias and a few imported plants that I've introduced from another country that are going to be released and take over. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to make this garden really, really perfect. I'm going to pruning it, shearing it, digging it, shoveling it. I'll fight off this entropy rubbish, this second law. It has no dominion over me, nor my garden. Yes, and so this is what we do. We try to fight off this crazy chaos thing, this crazy thermodynamics thing, by weeding it and looking after it. And that's great. You've got a lovely garden. I actually let my garden go, probably just because I'm lazy rather than because I'm any great worshipper of the second law, which I am, of course, but it's a whole other subject. But basically, your garden wants to go somewhere. It wants to go and become a forest, and you're stopping it. But in order to stop it, you have to put vast amount of energy in to stopping it. And so you yourself are generating entropy because you can never stop entropy. Any activity you take to stop it will create entropy itself. And this is why in our attempt to tame the world, in our attempt to increase our populations, in our attempt to breach the laws as such, we ourselves generate vast amount of entropy in our activities, basically. So the path of progress is against the path of nature. You are gardening against the forest. Nature wants to go to a forest. This planet wants to be a forest, basically. And you're trying to stop it. You're trying to stop it in your garden, but we're trying to stop it as a species on this planet. Our activities are geared towards holding back the natural order. And that is why we're getting into trouble. The path of progress is a path set exactly against sustainable biosphere. A sustainable biosphere will not be achieved through human progress. It will be achieved through human humility. That's how it will be achieved. It will be achieved by realizing that we are the vulnerable ones. Homo vulnerabilis would be our best name. Because we are dependent on the biosphere, ultimately, for our very survival. Yet we do not see that in bubble world. In bubble world, we have closed our eyes to the surrounding conversations that we could have with nature and with the rest of the planet. We have closed them off because we are Homo sapiens. We are Homo habilis. We will do and we will think our way ahead towards utopia. And that is the message of the Enlightenment. And that is why the Enlightenment philosophy is so very dangerous. And it's why it infiltrates so much of our thinking as we are. We need to recognize it for what it is and recognize the humans came from the biosphere. They were part of the biosphere. They interacted and conversed with the rest of the biosphere. But now we don't converse. Now we set ourselves against it as we set ourselves against everything else and closed ourselves off from that. So let's now look at conservation, because conservation represents the exact opposite. of the Enlightenment. I'll just quote Joni Mitchell, one of my favorite singers. We are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. I discovered something really quite depressing about that song. Joni wasn't actually, she didn't actually, unfortunately, get to Woodstock at all. And I always thought she was at Woodstock, and she was inspired to write that song by being there. But her manager said she'd be better appearing on a television program, a chat show, for her future career. And so she didn't go to Woodstock. She went to the chat show and appeared on that instead, the Dick Cotton chat show. And so I was really quite disillusioned about that, because I imagine Joni up there singing this beautiful song, inspired to write this song by being at Woodstock. And she didn't. She wrote it in New York after having talked to people who were there. But it's still a beautiful song in its own way. We are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. And that very much must be the conservation mantra. We want to restore ecology. We want to make it better. We want to put little plasters over it where we have slashed it with knives and we have torched it with flame and we have brutalized it with pollution and we have destroyed it with our progress. We want to make it better. That's a beautiful thought. Let's get out and put plasters on the trees. Let's hug them. Let's say we're sorry. Let's bring back the beavers. I got involved in a very controversial discussion on, it stemmed from Countryfile. I was on Countryfile and I was talking about the beaver reintroduction in Scotland. And I actually disagree with it. Nobody's booed, that's good. I did a talk the other day on this and I got a massive boo from a section of the audience. So I thought I was going to have to run for my life, but I want to explain why I don't agree with the reintroduction of beavers. I have nothing against beavers. Beavers are beautiful animals. They're a fantastic supply of aspirin if you've got a headache, but you have to kill them to get that. They eat the bark of Salix. Salix, of course, willow, and salicylic acid, which is aspirin, is concentrated in the bark of Salix. So they eat the bark, and they've got a little gland near their rump down here, which they put all of the aspirin in, basically all the salicylic acid is packed there. And it was known many centuries ago that if you ate this, it was a great cure for toothache. But they had to kill the beaver, unfortunately, to remove it. So I wouldn't recommend, if you get a toothache, trying to find a beaver. There aren't any in England, really, except in wildlife parks still. There haven't been any since about 1300. In Scotland, we held on to them until 1600. We had less toothaches, obviously, but I think that was the reason. But it was one of the reasons for their extinction, the Clostridium gland, which was very, very high in aspirin, basically, helped to lead to their demise, which was unfortunate. Anyway, up in Argyll, beautiful part of Scotland, they want to bring back the beaver. There was beavers in Scotland. Let's bring them back. Why am I opposed to this beautiful mammal being brought back to Scotland? Three reasons. Philosophically, first of all, the philosophy of ecology, basically. Sorry, the philosophy of conservation biology. We want to get back to the garden. In people's minds, the beaver is part of the garden. And any reintroduced species is part of the garden. It was there. It's no longer there. We can bring it back. It's a beautiful thought. How far back do you go? Where is Eden? We want to get back to the Garden of Eden. We want to have all the animals that were there, all the stuff that was there, all the things we've destroyed, all the little fluffy creatures, strange little things with orange ears and stuff. We want them all back. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. That's brilliant. Absolutely, totally right on. Totally agree with that. However, how far back do we go? I mean, we could set Scotland back 15,000 years. And what would we do then? We'd pour a massive amount of liquid nitrogen all over it to freeze it, because there was 2 kilometres of ice over all of Scotland 15,000 years ago. So we could restore it to that. There were only snow algae living on the top, maybe, of those ice age then. So we'd cover it in liquid nitrogen, we'd freeze it, and then we'd sprinkle some snow algae on top, and we'd have a restored habitat. That would be conservation biology. We'll go further back than that and try to bring some dinosaurs back, huge big guys thundering about, or even further back to the Silurian 400 million years ago, and we could restore a little place in Aberdeenshire called the Rhynie Chert and stick in a few very, very basic little psilotum-style tiny little plants that were there, and maybe a few centipedes that we've got record of existing there. and that would be it. We'd kill everything else. We'd have to kill the Scottish Wildcat, because that didn't belong then. It hadn't evolved yet. We'd have to kill a lot of the Scottish birds, because they weren't there either. Shoot all the birds, quick, we're trying to restore this habitat. There weren't any birds there. We've got to kill them all. Oh no, okay, let's go and shoot the birds. I really hope nobody just peeped into the tent there briefly and just heard my statement, shoot the birds, kill them all, because they're going to be heading out now and doing that. It's important to hear the whole message from a speaker always. Don't leave halfway through, or don't drop in, rather. Because, oh no, no, they're killing the birds. No, it's all my fault. What have I done? Oh dear. No, don't kill the birds. But if we did want to restore the ecology back to a time before the birds, we would have to kill all the birds. Agreed, I'm sure. So, philosophically, it's a difficult one. How far back do we go with the restoration? That's a tricky one. Secondly, ecologically, you've got beavers, okay? Beavers mate, just like nearly everything else does. So you have more beavers, and more beavers, and yet more beavers. And soon you're fighting your way to your car through a pile of beavers gnawing at all of your shrubs and slapping their tails about. There's one on the windscreen, you can't get it off. Wipers have no effect, beavers are quite big. Oh no, man, beavers everywhere. This is disastrous. You know, your kid's skateboarding along the pavement, hits a beaver, bad injury, you know, broken arm. Oh, because we forgot to introduce a predator. We didn't think about a predator. We didn't think about the balance of the natural system. And in Germany, they reintroduced beavers in the 1960s, and they now annually on the River Elbe go out and shoot beavers because they have to. They have to cull them because there are too many of them. The population's spiraled out of control. So there's an annual culling of beavers. So here we have this beautiful idea of introducing this gorgeous little beaver, but in our own minds, you've got to remember that we're going to be shooting their great-great-grandchildren on the banks of the Dee or wherever we put them. It'd be a nice folk song about that, possibly. It's you know, the folk songs are often very tragic and mark these great events. And I think it's fun to try to write future folk songs rather than folk songs about the past. Let's write some folk songs about where it's going to be. Ah, shooting the beavers one morning as I went out for me tea. You know, you could imagine how that could go. The Irish are good at this as well, obviously. So, and the English are brilliant. English great folk scene as well. So let's, you know, think about some songs about shooting beavers before we introduce them, and then maybe it'll make us think about introducing them. I'm all on for introducing the wolf. The wolf would save us having to cull the deer, because we need deer in Scotland. Deer are very important. Ecological managers, natural ecological managers. If you don't have them, you get a Sorbus acuparia, the rowan taking over our great forests. There's an area that's closed off in the Caledonian Forest on the south bank of the Loch Rannoch, the Black Woods of Rannoch. And in there, the forest has basically dissipated. There's no ground cover anymore because it's covered in rowans, because the deer would have nibbled those off. Rowans spread through bird droppings, and they spread rapidly if they don't have any herbivores. So it's the deer that were keeping the balance in the Caledonian forest, keeping it working. So we want deer, but we don't want too many of them, otherwise they eat everything. So we need the wolf. We have to shoot the deer in Scotland. We have to cull them. The wolf could solve that as well. But we don't like the wolf because it might eat our children. Oh no, it'll be waiting outside the primary school. There'll be loads of wolves, and they'll eat all the children. And that's just not on. But if you're not prepared to introduce the wolf, you shouldn't be prepared to introduce the beaver. Yeah, you shouldn't, because you're messing with the balance of nature. So you've got to think ecologically. So I've got ecological issues with reintroduction as well. And finally, I've got genetic issues with reintroduction. The genetic balance within a population is very, very important indeed. And if we get inbreeding, if beavers stay together and inbreed, then we get some serious problems arising, developmentally particularly, and it'll affect the next generation, or certainly two or three generations down the line. Inbreeding depression works very, very quickly. Now, if we get a bunch of beavers in Scotland, they've got the beavers, and they've got them all tagged. They've all got little necklaces on. And if any of them escape, they send out a taxi, basically, and drive them back. Now, after 2 years, beavers naturally disperse. When a beaver reaches 2 years old, happy birthday, son, now here's your passport, off you go. and the beaver heads off. Now, there's a reason for that, of course, because if the beaver's dead, not only would the population get bigger and bigger and bigger, but there would be the risk of inbreeding as well. And this natural dispersion means that that doesn't happen. The beavers go and move. And they move, maybe, and mate with beavers from other populations. And so we get a nice mixing of the genetic code as such. The variation is maintained by what we call metapopulation dynamics. That's movement between populations of particular individuals. So that works well. If we're driving them back in a taxi, it's not going to work. And that's what's happening up there. Now, why are we driving them back in a taxi, you might say? The reason is because most of the landowners don't want beavers, and they've only got permission to have them in a very small area. So what's the point in releasing beavers in Scotland if most of the landowners aren't going to want them? Several of the beavers have been shot, probably by a landowner who didn't want the beaver anywhere near their land. That's not a good outcome. So genetically, we don't want this system where we have to keep them in one small area. We need to allow them to disperse naturally, to do their thing. The natural balance of the system needs to be there. And so the beaver is a lesson to all of us. So what I'm saying really is that conservation biology is nice, but it's all about homo habilis again. It's do, do, do. We're always doing things. We're trying to fix it. We're trying to upwork it. We're trying to do it. And that's not the way to do it. That's not the way to go at all. The best thing you can do for conservation biology is not to plant trees in a field. As much as it sounds nice, don't. Because that field is not a forest now. It's a field with trees planted in it. And so if I got plastic surgery to convert myself into James Dean, I picked James Dean because he died at 27, wasn't it? So he was forever young. Forever young, that's a terrible song. James Dean died forever young. And I could look like James Dean. Oh my goodness, I'd have hair, I'd have a Porsche. Well, yeah, I could get a Porsche maybe. I don't know if that comes with a package or not. But I could crash it. Oh no, that's not so good. Anyway, I could look like James Dean. It'd be a lot better, easier for you to look up here. So I'm James Dean. I look like James Dean. However, I'm actually 45 years old and I'm twice the age of James Dean and I'll be getting older. I can't stop aging beneath the plastic surgery. If you try to alter a habitat, you don't alter it. You alter the surface of it. But the key system within a habitat is the soil, believe it or not. The fungi in the soil, the microbial processes in the soil. And in a succession, that gradually changes through time. Now, the field you choose to plant your trees in will not be a climax community succession. Most probably be an agricultural field, maybe, some sort of area like that, some area, maybe even industrial forest that you're converting into a natural forest, but it won't be because it'll have been humanly altered. The good thing about succession is it can reverse gear. We find that disturbed areas can recover, but they go backwards first before going forwards. It's like reversing out of a car park space. You've got a car parked here and a car parked here. You can't go forward. But you can reverse back and drive out that way. Succession does that quite handily. It can recover itself and then continue on the trajectory it was meant to be on as such, to the forest, the natural forest. So what you should do instead of planting trees is to get the field, surround it, preferably with electric fence and mines to stop us getting back in there and pruning something. Just get the humans out of there, basically, and leave it. And in 100 years' time, a blink of an eye in ecology, that will be returning to a forest along the correct path, along the natural path. And you won't need to touch it. You won't need to go back in and prune it and check it and do stuff to it. It'll be absolutely perfect. That's what it does. Because nature is absolutely perfect in its restoration. It's come back from mass extinctions. Giant bolides the size of Mount Everest striking the earth. Huge volcanic eruptions covering most of India and Pakistan, erupting onto the planet, the Deccan Plains, the Siberian traps of the Permian, vast areas of Siberia, the earth toxified, the atmosphere full of dust, no light getting in, just about everything dying. It came back every time. It didn't come back the way it was necessarily. So conservation is always about restoring form. It's not about that. Evolution is about function, not form. After every mass extinction, the function of the biosphere was restored impeccably to an identical state. there were different guys playing out the role, different actors. It's like you go in and shoot everybody in the Royal Shakespeare Company. Don't do this, please, either. Leave the birds alone, leave the Royal Shakespeare Company alone. But if you did go and shoot them because you wanted to be in the play, okay, and you didn't get accepted for the role, so I'm going to kill them all, and then I'll be Julius Caesar. Ha-ha. Yes, and unfortunately he got knifed by Brutus, but the guy hadn't read the entire plot. Anyway, you go in and some terrible accident happens. Let's not have shootings. Let's have some terrible accidents. All the Royal Shakespeare Company were going in, and a giant thing fell from the sky and killed them all. Awful thing to happen. And my sincere, obviously pass on condolences to the family. But it didn't really happen, so don't worry. Anyway, they're all dead. New players come in. They're all different in character, but they're reading the same play. And the play will be performed. It will still be Shakespeare. It will have different characters playing the roles. And after every mass extinction, we have different things that play the roles, but the function is restored. Because the story of this planet is not about form, it's about function. And so we need to rediscover our function on this planet, because we have a function as well. During one of those recoveries, the mass extinction of the Cretaceous when the dinosaurs were wiped out, and the little kind of line that became the primates sort of emerged, we emerged through either creative or natural, or however you want to interpret it, we emerged on the planet with a role to play. Because you don't emerge on the planet without a role. You're given your role as you emerge as such. You find your place on the planet. And we need to rediscover our place on the planet. And that place is a place of inefficiency. It's a place of balance. It's a place of flow. It's a place of continual cycling of energy at the appropriate level. That place is the biosphere. And that's where we need to get to. We've got to get away from the road of progress that we're on. Get off that. We've got to leave the conservation tools down and let nature restore itself. We've got to withdraw ourselves from doing and find our role as homo vulnerabilis, the vulnerable ones, within a place that we are destroying and that would eventually destroy us. Or we embrace it and we continue our wonderful experience of being on this beautiful planet for a little bit longer. Okay, so I'm going to finish there. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you've got something from that, and I'll say goodbye to you. So any quick questions? I could, a few minutes, yeah?
Anybody with a question?
I'm really sorry I came late, so you might have already answered this, but I'm connected to a conservation project where there was rapid deforestation in high Nepalese hills.
Okay.
So they went for rapid reforestation to prevent mudslides and land erosion and to give indigenous communities who've become impoverished work to do.
Exactly,
That's so it. Can you just offer...
Yes.
I'm sorry if you're having to backtrack to
offer
some analysis of that.
I'd be delighted to answer that. Yeah, that is not conservation. That is human protection. So two very different things. And there's nothing wrong with that. Protect the humans if you want to do that. That's great. But then get on with the conservation behind that and let the natural order reestablish itself. Totally. But the main thing to say is that is not conservation, because conservation is a gradual successional process. True conservation, I would say, is a gradual successional process where nature restores itself. That would be what I would view as conservation. But that's a very important thing that's being done there. Trees are key, as you know, to the water cycle. And we need more trees to avoid many of the great disasters of flooding. The more trees we have, the better. It's, as you know, it's an upside-down funnel for water to get up. So,
So you're saying rapid reforestation isn't conservation?
No.
It's just what? Rapid
It's
rapid
human protection.
Protection, thank you.
Protection of human settlements, which presumes why you're doing it, because the mud's going to come down and affect humans, yeah. So it's important to see what it is. But what it is very valuable. It's very valuable. You're saving lives. You're saving livelihoods. Absolutely, that's... No problem with that at all. But I'm just saying it's important to see that that's not natural succession, and therefore, to me, it's not what I would view as conservation. But it's a very important thing to do. So, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Can I ask another question? You said human protection is different and it's important. What about protection of some of the species, animals or something that is nearly extinct? Would you allow that?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. What should we do about extinction? First of all, speciation is usually dependent on extinction, except after a mass extinction. After a mass extinction, it's this complete emptiness, and so nature fills it with a diffusion of forms driven by DNA being gradually increasingly chaotic. So we get a diffusion of information from the DNA leading to a diffusion of forms filling the void that was left, a big, big event. Today, we're at an equilibrium just about, or we're not anymore, but at a sort of a leveling out area. We don't have big, big extinctions happening. Then, in order for something to evolve, we need something to go extinct, because we need a niche to open. It's like a high street. When all the shops are occupied, you want to open a shop there, you have to wait until one closes, and then you will open your shop where it was, basically. You can diffuse into that in an economic sense. Now, for species going extinct, the extinction rate is 200 times higher, as I said, than it was before. So we are creating all of this. What should we do? What we should do is, we cannot protect species. We must protect the biosphere, because the species are within the biosphere. It's like taking a chocolate mouse from a warm griddle and putting it into a frying pan. It will melt in either place. So you can take the chocolate mice out and you can make lots of more chocolate mice from it, have them breeding and a breeding program, and then you put them all back out there, you put them back into the same place that they were all killed in before. So, you know, how are you going to save the species? Forget about the species, you need to save the system, and then the species can live within that. So we need a very large scale restoration if we're going to save anything. Breeding up, captive breeding and releasing is not the way ahead. Because if you're releasing them back into a habitat that killed them in the first place, you haven't done anything at all. They're going to die anyway, basically. So, you know, we need to wake up to that. Species are no longer looked on, really, by ecologists, certainly, as the fundamental thing. It's called ecosystem functioning is what we're really absorbed with now. The functioning of the system. And if the system is functioning, then the forms will succeed within it. Species represent forms. They represent a consumption with form, which biology is hideously consumed with. Form, form, form. It needs to shift and get more consumed with function. And if this ecosystem is functioning, forms find their place within that functioning whole. And so what I would say is, yeah, restore the functioning, and then everything else will find its place, yeah.
You have been talking about ways of being efficient and ways of enhancing our lives by doing and thinking. Given that the biosphere seems to have a carrying capacity for human beings of something of the order of perhaps 3 billion, and there are 6 billion of us rising to 9 billion, you've already been talking about extinctions. Might we be seeing large-scale extinctions of Homo once sapiens unless we do something like we're doing now, or because we're doing something like now?
Yes, well, I've written a large section in my book on carrying capacity. It takes up a whole section of that. So, but I'll just very, very quickly summarize what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the carrying capacity of humans was reached probably around about 800-900 years ago on the planet, is what we think. And it came up at a level, it's been level for a long time. You've heard about the hockey stick curve that's meant to represent human growth. But the actual hockey stick, not the blade, the stick, is actually the equilibrium carrying capacity level. That's why it's so long. Because if you look at a normal population increase curve, the lag phase never lasts for the predominant length of the entire thing. So that isn't the lag phase. That is equilibrium. And then the increase since then, the blades going up, it has been an artificially engineered increase well above the natural carrying capacity. So we're not in carrying capacity realm anymore. We're in an artificial capacity that's way, way above where it would be. And we can maintain it there if we want. It will take continual energy to do that, because carrying capacity is an energetic concept. So to raise the carrying capacity, you need an increase in energy. That's the only way to achieve it. You need more energy flowing through it. So we are very good at that. And agriculture, which is one of the great producers of eutrophication, which is one of the greatest threats to the planet's diversity, burning carbon to power our lifestyles. Very little carbon is used in growing food. Most of the energy for that comes from the sun. The carbon being burned is really just lifestyle leisure energy. So we could certainly do without most of or all of that, actually, and rely solely on the solar input. Just eat and play and garden. No garden. Agriculture in a much more biosphere-friendly way, basically. Back to hunter-gatherer. We can't do any of that because we've got so many people now. There's so many people we need to feed. So we're going to I compare it to somebody who's built their house on four elephants. And the house is great, but you need to keep feeding the elephants to stay up there. And at 7 billion population, we need to feed a lot of elephants to hold that big house up there. And so we're doomed in terms of energy expenditure because we're going to have to keep feeding them. Otherwise, the population is going to collapse in a horrific and ugly way. And so, yeah, we're on this journey of continual energy input to maintain the population, let alone to cope with further increase. So let's not get that wrong. If we all stopped reproducing, you know, today back to a sensible level of one or two children each today, we'd still have to maintain this present population with huge energy expenditure. So therefore, we're going to run out of energy eventually, of course. There will be an end to the ice hockey sticks blade. It's unquestionably that's a reality, unless we can manage to bring it back round and back down in a sustainable way. And I'm talking 200 years' time, I'm not talking tomorrow, but in 200 years' time, we will have significant consequences on this planet due to the population and due to the energy required. And don't forget, the coal and oil are diminishing, so we'll have to switch to things like nuclear to get enough energy to maintain the present rate of lifestyle. So I say we need to reduce the population, yes, but I say that we need to reduce the energy use of ourselves primarily to immediately have an effect. One final statistic, and I'll have got time. One final point is that in 1900, the population was four times less than it is today. But Cohen, writing last year in Nature, said that the energy expenditure is 94 times more. So our population has gone up fourfold, the energy expenditure has gone up 94-fold. So per person, we have increased our energy expenditure 20-fold during that century. So we continue to, and don't forget that most people in the world aren't using as much energy as us. So we're probably using 40, 50 times more energy than the average person back then. So what we need to do is reduce that energy abuse to give ourselves a chance, really. So leisure energy, we can reduce. Feeding energy, survival energy, we can't really reduce that much, but we still can. We're eating about four times more food than we need to in the Western world, using 200 times more water than we need to. So all of that can be definitely pulled back. We can drastically cut our leisure expenditure, cars, that sort of stuff. We can drastically cut all of that, and therefore we can prolong our life our population's duration on the planet if we make these changes. But we've got to snap out of it. So that's what I'm saying. We need to escape from bubble world, from this progress-driven thing, and we need to look at the biosphere and get back into that, reintegrate into that, and get a control of population and get a control of energy expenditure.
Well, when Keith was introduced, I think somebody said you had the brain the size of Cheltenham. I think it's the size of the planet. So let's give him a really big green belt. Thank you.
That's good.